Welcome to Let's Talk FCA, presented by Kroll & Mooring. We're your co-hosts, Mona Lombardo and Jason Crawford, bringing you the latest developments in the False Claims Act. Today we're joined by our special guests, Rebecca Rosigliano and Steve Byers. Rebecca is a partner in Kroll's White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group, residing in our New York office. Prior to joining Kroll, Rebecca held numerous roles at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and most recently, she served as the first Assistant Attorney General of New Jersey. She's supervised complex criminal investigations and prosecutions and False Claims Act cases. And Steve is a partner in the firm's White Collar and Regulatory Enforcement Group, as well as the Government Contracts Group, and he resides in our D.C. office. Steve's practice involves counseling and representation of corporate and individual clients in all phases of white-collar criminal and related civil matters, and he focuses on matters involving procurement fraud and healthcare fraud. Welcome, Steve and Rebecca.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mona.
We've invited Steve and Rebecca to today's podcast to discuss issues pertaining to parallel civil and criminal proceedings in the False Claims Act context. We'll delve into what has led to more criminal investigations relating to false claims allegations and how a parallel criminal proceeding can impact an FCA investigation. Steve, can you start us off by explaining why and how we're seeing an increased risk of FCA cases going criminal?
Thanks, Jason. I think there are at least two reasons for this. First, a few years back, the Department of Justice adopted a policy under which every False Claims Act QUITAM complaint filed nationwide is reviewed by prosecutors in the fraud section of the criminal division for possible criminal investigation and prosecution. So that's a much more rigorous system than existed in the past, when it was essentially left up to DOJ lawyers and agents on the civil side to spot and refer possible criminal cases to their criminal prosecution counterparts. So, for example, our partner, Laura Cordova, when she was head of the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force in the Criminal Division's Fraud Section, reviewed every healthcare QUITAM complaint for these purposes. The same is true for procurement fraud QUITAMs, which are reviewed by prosecutors in the Fraud Section's Securities and Financial Fraud Unit. And DOJ has also ramped up the number of prosecutors and agents who pursue these cases. Another recent shift in DOJ policy is the so-called Yates Memo. The Yates Memo was issued by then Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates late in the Obama administration. Its official title is Individual Accountability for Corporate Wrongdoing. And the Yates Memo essentially requires DOJ lawyers and corporate defendants seeking cooperation credit to focus closely on individual culpability in corporate fraud cases. And what's especially notable about the Yates Memo in this context is that it explicitly applies not only to criminal cases, where individual culpability has always been a focus, but also civil False Claims Act cases. So as a result, whereas in the past it was relatively rare to see individuals named by the government as defendants in False Claims Act cases, that's now becoming more common. And that has the potential to inject dynamics more common in criminal cases into civil False Claims Act cases. So, for example, there may be a need to hire separate counsel for employees who are summoned to testify pursuant to civil investigative demands. And that may in turn lead to individuals invoking their Fifth Amendment rights. That creates a host of problems, not the least of which is attracting the attention of the criminal division of either Maine Justice or a U.S. Attorney's Office. And we've actually seen that happen in one instance I can think of. The civil DOJ lawyer responsible for a False Claims Act investigation approached the criminal division about immunizing an individual who took the Fifth, and that itself sparked a criminal investigation in that False Claims Act case.
So, Rebecca, as a former prosecutor, can you comment on how the policy developments that Steve discussed practically impact FCA civil and criminal interplay within a U.S. attorney's office?
Sure, but I want to touch on something Steve said about the Yates memo. Well, not to understate its importance, the Yates memo has been quite the focus of discussion over the past few years. And what's interesting is that the core instruction in the Yates memo, which is to hold individuals who perpetrated corporate wrongdoing accountable, it's not a new phenomenon. Federal prosecutors across the country have always evaluated the evidence against individuals in determining whether to bring criminal charges. There's nothing new about that. Oftentimes, it's difficult to prove, and federal prosecutors elect not to prosecute or not to charge individuals, but the desire to do so and the instruction to do so has always been there. The Yates memo didn't change that, but it emphasized steps that prosecutors and civil DOJ lawyers and AUSAs must take and memorialize prior to the conclusion of investigation into corporate wrongdoing. And because we're talking about the Yates memo, it's worth noting over the past year that DAG Rosenstein has made several references to review of policies that's underway at DOJ, including the Yates memo. Now, other than a reference to changes that would make policy, quote, clear and concise, unquote, there have been really no specifics provided. So in the words of my former boss, Preet Bharara, stay tuned on that front. But to get to your question about the interplay between civil and criminal investigations, they're conducted like any other parallel investigation with the same guidelines and prohibitions. So, for example, a criminal prosecutor cannot share information pertaining to a grand jury's activities pursuant to Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure with someone on the civil side. An attorney who's representing an individual will likely see that individual's interview conducted by the U.S. Attorney's Office criminal team or the DOJ criminal team and attended by civil enforcement attorneys as well. So again, generally, the same rules, guidelines, structures apply that you would see in any other parallel investigation. And practitioners therefore need to be mindful of the same pitfalls they would have when representing an individual in any other investigation involving multiple agencies. Steve also mentioned cooperation by corporations, which involves disclosure of all relevant facts about the wrongdoing known to the corporation. And although the issues surrounding privilege and work product and waiver with respect to disclosures of facts to the government is complex enough, candidly, to merit its own podcast, we'd be remiss not to flag those considerations for practitioners here, because they must be aware of the threat of waiver of protections in their efforts to cooperate with the government.
Thanks, Rebecca. Steve, you mentioned that these policy developments have the potential to inject aspects of criminal investigations into civil FCA investigations. What are some of the ways in which FCA investigations and litigation may be impacted?
Well, for starters, I mentioned the separate representation of individuals may be necessary. That's driven mainly by the rules of professional responsibility. Generally speaking, a lawyer for the company, whether in-house or outside, cannot jointly represent an individual unless the lawyer is absolutely certain that if she were representing only the individual, she could unequivocally advise the witness that it's in his best interest to testify, regardless of where the company's interest may lie. And given the increased focus on individual culpability and the heightened risk of criminal investigation, that judgment call is becoming more complicated. And once you have separate counsel in the picture, you have to make decisions about whether to enter into a joint defense agreement and the terms under which information will be obtained from and shared with the separately represented individual and his counsel. And I'll elaborate on that a little bit more in just a moment. But I also mentioned Fifth Amendment invocations. That can be disastrous, not only because it raises the specter of a criminal investigation, but because of the risk of adverse inferences. And what do I mean by adverse inferences? Well, generally speaking, in federal cases, in most circuits, Fifth Amendment invocations by an employee can be used as the basis for adverse inferences against the corporate employer in a civil case, including a Civil False Claims Act case. So specifically, jurors may be instructed that they can infer that, had the questions been answered truthfully by the witness, in other words, had the witness not interposed the objection and declined to answer based on Fifth Amendment rights, had those questions been answered truthfully by the witness, the information provided would have been favorable for the government or the quitam relator, and unfavorable to the corporate defendant. And that is an incredibly powerful weapon in a jury trial.
A powerful weapon indeed. Rebecca, how can a company dealing with a civil FCA investigation be on the lookout for signs that a civil FCA investigation may be pursued by the government as a criminal matter?
The answer is quite simple: by conducting a thorough internal investigation, really understanding the facts and answering basic questions. Was the conduct at issue knowing or negligent? Was it done with purpose? Were there many individuals involved at all levels of the company, including executives, or was it just one or two individuals? Did the conduct go on for a sustained period of time, or was it quickly discovered and corrected? Getting your arms around the facts as an attorney, getting the answers to those questions and similar questions, will inform whether there is a potential for the initiation of a criminal case. And it will also afford the company's lawyers the opportunity to meet with the civil and possibly criminal attorneys in an attempt to persuade them not to initiate a criminal case, but to have it remain civil. And also, candidly, keeping your eyes open. getting the facts from the company about the agency looking into the matter. When a CID was served, were there regulatory or criminal agents conducting interviews? Knowing that will give the attorneys representing the corporation clues into where the government is at.
Thanks, Rebecca. So, Steve, if there are signs that an FCA investigation might go criminal, what can a company do to mitigate the consequences of acts that could be viewed as criminal conduct?
Well, echoing what Rebecca just said, I think it's absolutely essential for corporate counsel to keep an eye out for criminal intent when conducting False Claims Act and similar investigations. You have to do that because a failure to self-report such conduct to the criminal division could have severe negative consequences if a civil investigation later goes criminal. DOJ has a corporate cooperation policy that has become more and more formalized in recent years. And DOJ's goal there, of course, is to incentivize corporations to report criminal conduct. The carrot is cooperation credit, which can spare a company from any criminal consequences entirely in certain circumstances. But that requires self-reporting and robust cooperation. Which brings me back to joint defense agreements with individuals. Now, that's quite common in ordinary civil litigation, but it's an example of the complex dynamics at work here. Most lawyers who deal with False Claims Act and similar matters are familiar with Upjohn warnings, under which employee witnesses are instructed that the company holds and may waive the privilege protecting the substance of a witness interview. Under that approach, should the day come when full cooperation with the government is in the company's best interest, you'll be free to disclose information obtained from the employee witness. But that's not so if you've entered into a joint defense agreement, which normally requires that the individuals consent to disclose information be obtained from him. So that will put you in a very awkward situation when you're sitting across from a prosecutor who holds the company's fate in her hands, and you have to tell her, essentially, I have some really valuable information for you, but I can't share it with you because I entered into a joint defense agreement with an individual who's the subject of your investigation. That is not a good position to be in. And in that same vein, you have to keep in mind from the very outset of a False Claims Act investigation that the contents of your witness interview memos may have to be disclosed down the road in order to get cooperation credit. And that can lead to the drafter of the memo becoming a witness in subsequent proceedings. In fact, there's a recent case that so holds. So from the very beginning, you have to proceed accordingly and very carefully.
Great. Well, that's all for this episode. We want to thank Rebecca and Steve for joining us today and sharing their thoughts on parallel criminal and civil FCA proceedings. If you have any questions, Mona can be reached at 213-443-5563 and Jason at 202-624-2562. We'll see you next time on Let's Talk FCA.
Let's Talk FCA is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. You can find more information at kroll.com/podcasts.